This podcast is coming to you from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. For more UBC podcasts and more UBC, go to www.ubc.ca. The following podcast is Saving Tuna, Lessons from Cod Mismanagement, February 18, 2008, at the American Association for the Advancement of Science News Briefing in Boston, Massachusetts, where UBC Professor Daniel Pauly joined Stanford's Barbara Block, World Wildlife Fund's Jose Inglis, and UBC Professor Rashid Samaya in arguing that tuna may follow cod to possible extinction unless we change how we approach managing both migratory species and the broader ecosystem they inhabit. Pauly introduces the overall issues. Block argues that the sushi economy is pushing tuna to the brink of collapse. Inglis asks governments and NGOs to help protect juvenile tuna in the Coral Triangle area by removing fish aggregation devices and implementing transboundary marine parks. And Samaya posits the question, whose fish are we eating, ours or our grandchildren's? And says we must act now as if we are negotiating with future generations on catch levels in order to tackle the problem of overfishing.
Welcome, everybody, to the last press conference of the AAAS in this wonderful city of Boston. We have the theme today is how to save tuna. We have four speakers. One is Daniel Pauly from the University of Columbia, Vancouver. The second will be Barbara Block of Stanford University. The third will be Jose Inglis of the World Wildlife Fund in the Philippines. And the fourth will be Rashid Samaya of the University of British Columbia, again in Vancouver. I will ask the speakers to restate their name and affiliation for the benefit of those of you who are taping this. And I will ask Daniel to begin. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Daniel Pauly, of the Director of the Fishery Center in the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And this parallel session on cod and tuna. And before we had this session, we were asked, what do they have in common? What brings you together, researchers on cod and researchers on tuna, together? And they have, because usually you don't cook dishes where these two things come together. So, first of all, they are both extremely abundant. There's one species of cod. You can also consider the relative, but it's essentially a species, Atlantic cod, which in the North Atlantic has shaped the fate of entire civilization. For example, Norway, and the North Sea also, and also Iceland and Canada, very much have been shaped by the catching of cod, and immense quantities of them. Also, tuna, various species, occur in the open ocean throughout the world, immense quantity of them, and have shaped also cultures, for example, the Mediterranean cultures. They are extremely well-studied species, and we never going to know more about any single species than we know about Atlantic cod. And we exploit fish throughout the world, knowing much less than we have known about cod. So that's what they have in common. The major difference is that the experiment we conduct with fish, and it is a large experiment, which is, can we collapse them? Can we collapse fish? Has brought fruit with cod? We can. And this has been the case for the major stocks of cod in the North Atlantic, notably in off New England, northern of Canada, and many stocks in around the North Sea, for example, in the Kattegat. They are reduced at 1, 2, 3% of the original abundance, and people are arguing still about continuing to fish them instead of rebuilding them. And the collapse have happened in spite of all this knowledge that we had, that we thought we had on them. The question then is, are we going to do the same thing with the tunas? And there is at least one species or one population of a species, you will hear more from Barbara Block about this, where this is, we're close to it, that is the giant that's born in the Gulf of Mexico. There is also an enormous spawning area and juvenile area in a so-called triangle in between the Philippines, the Indonesia, and Papua New Guinea. And this enormous triangle is fished extensively with a aggregation device, tuna aggregation device, which enabled the capture of juveniles. And Jose Ingles will talk about this. This is an area of the world where the trend could be reversed that has affected the fisheries on this species. And I would conclude, because I'm serving only as the one who present the introduction, I would conclude with saying that on land we have actually known to reverse the decline of the iconic species, which was exploited for its ivory, which is much more valuable than sushi for that matter. And by banning the trade of ivory, the elephants was could bounce back. Lots of initiative were needed on the ground to do that. And we need to do that for the tunas, and especially for bluefin, which are in bad shape and similar to elephants, require active intervention to not go the same way that cod have gone. I'm done.
Thank you very much. Barbara.
I'm Barb Block, and I'm from Stanford University, and I study tunas and large open sea fish. Giant tuna are magnificent animals, long renowned for their large size and transoceanic migrations. The three species of bluefin are the pinnacle of bony fish evolution. They have a unique capacity to maintain warm bodies like a mammal or bird while traversing frigid seas. Their biology has led to apex predator status, safe at the top of the food web, safe until our generation took notice of them. Bluefin have been fished sustainably by man for millennia. Their flesh built civilizations surrounding the Mediterranean. Their images graced Roman and Phoenician coins over 2,000 years ago. They were revered by another generation of humans. But today, they're sought on an industrial scale by sushi connoisseurs who savor the bluefin's delicate flavor and ruby red mussels. Fishermen are compensated the price of a year at Stanford University, $45,000, for a single fish in what has become known as the sushi economy. In the North Atlantic, recent scientific data confirms there are at least two populations of bluefin tuna, one that breeds in the Gulf of Mexico and the other in the Mediterranean Sea. When I was born almost 50 years ago, bluefin that swam from Boston shore to the spawning ground in the Gulf of Mexico had not yet been exploited. The bluefin's myoglobin-rich mussels did not suit our Yankee palates. They were virgin and unfished. In contrast to the Med with its 3,000 years of bluefin fishing, these giants swam free in 1950. These two giants, who were over 600 pounds when at 12 to 14 years of age they spawned for the first time, lived for over 30 years. And today, the genes of these giants still swim in the third or fourth generation offspring in the Gulf of Mexico tuna today, but their population is on the brink of collapse. It has happened on our watch in my lifetime. The U.S. commercial fishers can no longer find bluefin, and we've not been able to catch our restrictive quota the past three fishing seasons. Now, to study bluefin is very difficult. Their size and vast movement across the high seas make it hard to find them. Our team has pioneered electronic tagging to map the travels and behaviors of the elusive bluefin, and we're close to catching and tagging the 1,000th giant with an electronic tag after spending many years chasing them at sea. Tagging and genetic data from our program reveal that bluefin in the North Atlantic fishery are indeed composed of two populations unique in their migrations, genetics, and life history. We've tracked eastern fish flocking to the western Atlantic, like European tourists enjoying a favorable exchange on the dollar. and we've seen less frequently our Gulf fish going over to European shores. Genetics document separate Atlantic bluefin tuna populations, yet tagging indicates significant mixing exists across the North Atlantic in productive foraging zones. The Central Atlantic, once thought to be a no-man's land that separated the western and eastern fisheries, is actually a hotspot for fish and fishermen alike. International longliners have slammed both populations there during the past decade. Due to the mixing of bluefin from west to east and east to west, the rampant overfishing in the East Atlantic and Mediterranean threatens not only the future of the eastern population, but impacts greatly the western population. We need eastern fishing to come down to ensure the future of both fisheries. Importantly, eastern fish swimming in our western waters are artificially inflating the estimates of the remaining western giants, adding a subsidy. Recent science reveals we're not letting the western bluefin reach maturity and reproduce in the Gulf of Mexico. Immense overfishing in international fisheries in the Atlantic and Med, and continued bycatch of bluefin in the closed Gulf of Mexico spawning area has precipitated the slow rebuilding of our rarer Gulf of Mexico stock of bluefin. Recruitment of the Gulf of Mexico stock is failing. Young bluefin are increasingly hard to find along our North American coast. Technological advances and improvements in our understanding of the life history of bluefin increasingly have shown us that we can actually make precise effort controls with superb spatial units. And yet the policy challenge of preventing overfishing has still to be overcome. Like cod, bluefin have shaped human culture in the marine ecosystem, and like cod, we have eaten them to death. But unlike cod, we have the science in hand today to rebuild bluefin tomorrow. The question is whether managers at home and abroad have the will to act fast enough. Prudent management measures implemented now based on robust science can bring about a resurgence of bluefin tuna, preventing them from going the way of the cod. Thank you.
Jose. I'm Jose Inglis, tuna strategy leader for the Coral Triangle Program of the World Wildlife Fund. This study highlights the issue of high volume of juvenile yellowfin and big-eye tunas taken by the fishery the Coral Triangle countries that include Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, and up to Fiji, creating ecological, economic, and social impacts on the people that depend on this fishery. For some less understood reason, the juveniles of these two species form schools with skipjack tuna of similar sizes. As a consequence of this behavior, an estimated total of 247,000 tons or equivalent to about 16% of the entire skipjack catch are taken as bycatch by this fishery. The revenues generated from the sale of these juveniles are a mere $231 million, a small amount compared to about $1.5 billion if we let these juvenile tunas grow to mature sizes. This translates to a potential loss of $1.2 billion in 2006 alone. The situation is far more serious in coastal fisheries where juvenile tuna catch of Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, and the Philippines combined produces an additional 254,000 metric tons. The volume of juvenile tunas has increased sixfold since 1980. This increase is mainly attributed to the increasing use of and dependence to fish aggregation devices. These are floating structures set at sea that effectively attract these tunas, making them very easy to catch. The use of these structures is recommended. Its popularity, one of the main reasons for its popularity is it was a recommended solution to minimize the dolphin-related deaths associated with this fishery in the U.S. In addition, the high cost of fuel have forced fishers to use these devices to save on cost, while the growing scarcity of tunas in the nearshore areas have forced poor fisher folks to effectively herd the few remaining fish at sea. The highly migratory and transboundary nature of these two tuna species adds to the complexity of coming up with a simple solution. All throughout its life stage, as it swims from jurisdiction of one country to the next, these tunas are exploited by poor fisher folks Because they stay only at a very short period of time, there is an incentive to take as much as possible, irrespective of their size or whether they're legal or illegal. The solution proposed here is for the Coral Triangle countries to form themselves into small tuna groups, acting independently to develop a combination of resource and market-based solutions designed to complement the work of regional management offices. It has been started in the region, for example, with Indonesia and the government of the Philippines, looking at the creation of transboundary marine peace parks, whose goal is to protect the critical life stages of these tunas, particularly the spawning nursery as well as their migratory routes. Using these initial conservation investments, these governments could use these good intentions to rally consumers and markets to support development of incentive schemes to help support raise funds to compensate for losses arising from protecting the juveniles and to support the management of tuna resources. However, key to the solution is to find market countries that are willing to reform the management of tunas. This is a difficult task, and we are treading on new solutions we know very little about. We could not wait, however, for the regional management organization to act on the issue of catching juvenile tunas. We could not let history of the cut repeat itself in this region. Thank you.
Rashid.
I am Rashid Smaila, Director of the Fisheries Economic Research Unit at the Fisheries Center, University of British Columbia in Canada. Recent economic analysis by our team has led me to ask the following question. Whose fish are we eating, ours or our grandchildren's? To tackle the problem of overfishing, we must act as if future generations of people are alive and negotiating with us now on catch levels. Comparing the fate of tuna to that of cod provides warning signs that tuna stocks are on track to follow the same disastrous decline as we have seen for North Atlantic cod. Now, cod fisheries in Atlantic Canada and the U.S. now provide less than 1% of what they used to deliver. On the other hand, landed values from big eye and yellowfin tuna in the western central Pacific are currently providing more than 60% of what they used to give. So they are not in such a bad shape compared to cod. A key reason why we see such a dramatic decline in cod landed values is that we value our grandchildren's fish as if they were for us. For people who were here 100 years ago, the fish that any one of us here has eaten this week is valueless to them. But of course, to us, it's quite valuable. Similarly, for people who will be here 100 years from now, the fish they will eat, from our perspective, is not valuable. But to them, that will be quite valuable. And the current generation needs to factor this into our fisheries valuation approaches if these resources are to be sustainable and made available to future generations too. The consequence of counting the future generations' fish as if they are ours is that we allow short-term considerations, whether political, economic, social, to dominate our decisions on how much fish to catch today versus how much to leave for the future. Our work has shown that had we counted the cod that our grandchildren will eat as their cod, the biomass of the cod of Newfoundland would have been more than 16 times what they are today. Can the fate of cod in the North Atlantic befall tuna in the Western Central Pacific? The answer is a resounding yes if we fail to take immediate action because, as described by earlier speakers on this panel, the situation in this region is even more complex and difficult. Big eye and yellowfin tuna are shared stocks, not only by domestic local countries, but also by distant water fishing fleets. That makes it more difficult to manage. A significant number of fishers in this region are poor compared to fishers in Canada or the U.S., for example. The price of tuna is a driver to overfishing. and we have large quantities of juvenile bycatch, as mentioned earlier. We need to establish joint management arrangements that see local countries receive a share of adult tuna fishery yields from distant water fishing nations in return for allowing the juvenile population to mature. To ensure that future generations are not left behind, whenever you catch or eat fish, ask yourself, whose fish, yours or your grandchildren's? This idea stems from a new approach to valuing flows of benefits from natural and environmental resources known as intergenerational discounting. This is a new and growing idea in economics that has the chance to help us balance short and long-term fisheries benefits and thereby achieving the twin goals of conserving tuna and other fishery resources and giving future generations the option to also meet their fish protein needs. The approach has the potential to help us stop discounting away our natural environment and therefore the lives of future generations. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks to all four speakers. And before we begin the questions, just an important and perhaps poignant announcement. I said this was the last press conference, but there is one other event. It will be a media availability. And if you want to, you can go to room 303, which is straight above us, and hear David Baltimore, Jim Yong Kim from Harvard, Peter Pio from the United Nations, and Timothy Worth from the United Nations Foundation talking about global health challenges. That's 303 in this building at 9:15. Who has a question?
Europe, several retailers have stopped stocking bluefin. I don't remember their name, but I know one of them is Mikro. It's a big retailer in Switzerland and in part of Germany. I read a news item of that sort, and that can easily be checked. And this is because of the situation of bluefin in the eastern Atlantic. Such initiative, the Marine Stewardship Council is one. To the extent that you have traceability, you can do that. Unfortunately, retailers and restaurants try to suppress traceability because it allows them to substitute a lot. And this work against such initiative, market-led initiative, which are being proposed, that's a problem. Traceability. There are legislation, for example, in the U.S., that has begun the work of getting the traceability back in line with forcing the countries of origin to be labeled. But this will require quite a bit of work to have traceability everywhere.
About the poisoning of tuna.
Yeah, I think the mercury content, in tuna has been reported to be quite high, and I think it's already started. There are few people who stay away from tuna, and especially
pregnant
women, ladies.
We should avoid eating tuna in large quantities.
Again.
We actually have to catch it. That's the hardest part. And then we pull it up on the deck. We keep a hose in the mouth, keep oxygen going through the gills. And then we actually put a tag, the price of a laptop, inside the tuna with a brief surgery turn the fish around, let it go, and it has to be recaptured by a fisherman who then returns the tag. It has four languages on it that says, return me for a big reward. And successfully in the Atlantic, 20% of our tags of the archival type have been returned and 50% in the Pacific. So we've been able to actually use this internal tag surgically successfully. There's a pop-up satellite tag that also can ride on a tuna and then detach from the tuna, come up, and report back its data through satellites.
I can't resist asking, doesn't the return rate tell you something already quite ominous about the tuna?
Absolutely. So there's a high mortality that's evident in the archival tag return rate. So 20% of the tags we put in the ocean in the Atlantic get returned. 50% of the tags we put in the Pacific and northern bluefin tuna get returned. I think that on bluefin tuna, it's fundamentally a policy issue of bringing overfishing down in the Mediterranean and East Atlantic first, and then a policy issue in the West Atlantic of should we actually be fishing in our spawning ground as a bycatch fishery. Beyond that, I think that if we could bring the fishing pressure down, if we could discuss the policy issue of one nation consuming 90% of the world's bluefin tuna, then we might be able to actually address this issue of overfishing of bluefin tuna.
Yeah, please.
In addition, you know, there's a question of implementation of policy. If you check out, many countries have in their rules or acts, or some even in the constitution, Namibia has it, that we should manage our fisheries resources for the benefit of both current and future generations. The problem comes when you talk about implementation and all the pressures that come upon governments and managers and scientists and so on. And that is why it is important to keep this in mind. Whose fish are you eating? And hopefully that goes right through the whole chain from the catcher to the consumer. Somehow we might be able to turn this around so we can implement the policies that look good on the paper.
Another way of looking at it is how we have the science, we have the policies. How much money is devoted to surveillance to make sure that what you are trying to implement is actually happening on the ground? Very few countries in the developing world, for example, have vessels, or not to speak of or planes, to actually track the fishery. And to the extent that they don't have vessels to check, there will be an immense amount of what is known as IUU, illegal, unreported, and undocumented catches.
What could I add to that? For the yellowfin and juveniles, I think we have enough science to put some precautionary measures in place, but it doesn't prevent us from furthering our understanding of how tunas behave in these floating structures that would give us a management and handle on how a policy would develop.
Question was about tuna ranching and yes.
On the tuna ranching, they started, to my knowledge, it started in Australia, but it actually is conducted really big scale in the Med. And the problem with this is that the fish that are caught is an added pressure on a stock which was not considered to be fishy because they were not killed. And when they were killed later, they were part of aquaculture production. That's a joke, actually, because they were kept. They are kept about 6 months in pens, and they are fattened. Now, in they are fattened with the sardine and anchovies that are caught. Now, in the Med, you know that all countries around the Med are countries that happily eat anchovies and sardines. So this has led to an immense, intense competition between human use and or local human use and human use for people who import the tuna. And the loser in this competition has actually been marine mammal and bird, who have actually no food. And the Med is the first place where marine mammal exists that actually starve to death. And this is the case for the common dolphin in the Gulf of in the eastern Mediterranean around Greece, who are starved and who are whose population has dwindled, that they are now very rare. They will have to be renamed from common dolphin to not very common dolphin, because they are starving dolphin. Yeah. So this tuna fattening business is probably a money making business, but like all business that have an extreme concentration of a rich product and a very valuable product, it has been taken over by mafias. And this is not about mafias, a generic one, but the real one in the Med is running various operations in the various countries. And the people who study it have been often threatened for digging too deep.
Yeah, Ken, the future of bluefin is bright only when it comes to spawning bluefin in captivity. Japan has done the unimaginable. They've actually successfully spawned bluefin tuna, and there's actually a great interest across the globe right now in sustainable aquaculture for bluefin and doing it in a way that's actually farm-friendly, where the protein that the tunas eat isn't coming from the sea but coming from homegrown plants. So there's a tremendous interest in this area, and it's exploding across the globe. There's programs probably on three continents now to husbandry bluefin tuna and actually to bring about the successful spawning as Japan has done.
When questions fall away like this, I actually conclude that either you're not interested, and I know that's not true because I've had the privilege of watching you for the last 5 days, or you're just overwhelmed by the irresistible logic and implacable force of the arguments that have been put forward. And I much prefer to think of that, because I think this is a great story. Okay, folks, this is the end of all the press conferences, but can I remind you that in room 303 there will be an availability where four great people will talk about a great theme. Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to a podcast from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. For more UBC podcasts and more UBC, go to www.ubc.ca.